وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The new extreme right-wing Israeli cabinet has started its work with some controversial and provocative moves, although it has assumed power for only about a week. The visit by the hardliner minister Itamar Ben-Gavir to Al-Aqsa Mosque earlier this week drew widespread condemnations from not only the Muslim world, but even the U.S. The same minister has visited Nafa prison today to make sure the conditions of the inmates have not improved and that they don't have, quote, excessive rights, a move that Hamas has slammed as an unprecedented criminal act. The Tel Aviv regime has also issued financial and political sanctions against the Palestinian Authority. We'll discuss these issues in tonight's Spotlight program with our guests. Kevin Barrett, editor of Veterans Today, joining us from Madison. And also Lebanese journalist Sandos Al-Assad, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, it's great to have you with us. Let's start off with Mr. Barrett in Madison. The United Nations Security Council has voiced concern about the status quo of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound following this provocative visit by the Israeli minister. That's just more platitudes and no action. Why did the Security Council yet again fail to act against another Israeli violation?
Well, the UN Security Council has been running interference for the Zionists for quite some time, even though the Zionists are the biggest international outlaws and criminals, the violators of the most UN resolutions of any country on earth, they're still given a pass. And probably a lot of the reason for that is that they have so much power in several of the countries that make up the Security Council. So we shouldn't expect the United Nations to solve this problem, certainly not the Security Council as it's currently structured. If it were changed and restructured and became more reflective of the world's population, then that might change. But as it stands right now, this most extreme Israeli government in history, with people like Ben-Gavir, who basically worships Baruch Goldstein, the perpetrator of the Hebron massacre, a serial killer and maniac, and Ben-Gavir used to have a big picture of him on his wall that he bowed to, I guess. This guy is a complete, there's really nobody. There's no genocidal maniac on earth today that you could find that could really beat this guy in the sweepstakes for that title. He's now taking up where a long list of other Zionist extremists have left off in terms of provoking violence by attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the oldest and greatest Islamic architectural monument, and trying to set the stage ultimately for demolishing it, as many of these maniacal, ultra-extremist, messianic, millenarian Zionists want to do. So he's taking up where people like Ariel Sharon left off prior to 9/11, when Sharon's job was to set the stage for the post-9/11 crushing of the Palestinians in the run-up to that Israeli demolition of the Twin Towers in New York. So these guys right now in this current government are just completely beyond the pale in terms of anything that even ultra-Zionists like Thomas Friedman of the New York Times can even imagine ever stomaching, and yet the United Nations and the international community are letting them get sure. away with it. And it makes you wonder, what wouldn't they let them get away with?
Ms. Al-Assad, at the United Nations Security Council session, the Palestinian UN envoy said, quote, what red line must be crossed for the Security Council to finally say enough is enough? I think it's safe to say that many of those red lines have already been crossed by the Israelis on numerous occasions.
I believe that the United Nations is complicit in the atrocities that have been that are being held against the Palestinians. The United Nations, we have seen how the United Nations act with double standards policy regarding the issue of Iran, for example, the issue of Russia, the issue of China. They all the time condemn these countries while and sanction them, but they don't sanction the usurping occupation entity. So I don't believe that the United Nations will do justice for the Palestinians. The only thing that will do justice for the Palestinians is the righteous right of resistance. This is the only option that the Palestinians must must uphold, because the Zionists are there's no a good Zionist and a bad Zionist. The old Zionists are occupiers, and the Palestinians have the right to defend themselves and to get rid of this occupation.
Kevin Barrett, the Israelis, as we've seen, act with impunity as they are above the law. How has the insufficient international response and lack of action from international bodies such as the UN, the EU, the OIC, and most notably Arab governments contributed to this status quo?
Well, the international institutions are set up to fail. We don't have real international institutions now. What we have is a kind of a set of institutions, starting with the United Nations, that are fig leaves for the protection of power by the powerful. And for that reason, there was never any real intent to have these institutions enforce any kind of just international law. Instead, they provide cover, again, for, like, the U.S. wanted to wage a war in Korea, so they got the United Nations to approve the Korean War, and right on through the Iraq War, these other kinds of interventions. We always see that the United Nations is not representing a majority of the people of the planet. It's essentially just, again, providing cover for the biggest imperial and state interests. So the real question here is not so much why have the international institutions failed. That's what they do. That's what they're designed to do. But rather, why haven't any national governments tried to do something about this? And the first national governments that we would expect to stand up for the Palestinians would be the regional governments, the Arab countries, the Palestinians or their fellow Arabs, and of course the Muslim world, and to some extent one would expect the Christian world as well to not particularly appreciate the way the Zionists are committing genocide against Christians in the traditional home of Christianity. But none of those governments, with a very few exceptions, the Islamic Republic of Iran is one of them, have been doing anything to try to stand up for the Palestinians. And they mostly have, in the past, pretended to be, you know, they give lip service, and every now and then one of them has actually helped out the Palestinians. Saddam Hussein did that in Iraq. Muammar Gaddafi did that in Libya, and then they paid the price. And I think the other leaders in the region sort of got the message that the Zionist-controlled West is going to come in and make your life miserable unless you dance to their tune. And so the people of the region, as we saw in the World Cup, are completely opposed to Zionism and virtually unanimous in their ardent desire for the liberation of Palestine. But most of the leaders in the region are not in line with that because they find it's more in their interest to play ball with the world's biggest powers. And what will make that change, I don't know. Maybe as the Palestinian the Palestinian resistance becomes more popular worldwide, including here in the West, even in the Jewish communities of the West, the younger people tend to be more sympathetic to Palestinians. And as the people in the region put pressure on their governments, maybe that will bring some change.
Ms. Al-Assad, what do you see behind this latest wave of Israeli aggression and provocations, especially the recent storming of Al-Aqsa by the far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir? Why now?
Because unfortunately, the rulers, the so-called Muslim rulers, are complicit in these aggressions that are being taken in Al-Aqsa Mosque, desecrating Al-Aqsa Mosque and killing the Palestinians. Four Palestinian children have been killed since the onset of this new year. We saw that the Arab monarchs, the Persian Gulf monarchs, are normalizing ties with the Zionists, shamefully normalizing ties with this occupation, and doing nothing to the Palestinians. They said that the so-called Abraham Accords will bring peace and justice for the Palestinians. We haven't seen this justice. The only thing, as I have mentioned earlier, that will bring justice for the Palestinians is the armed resistance. The armed resistance is the key for freeing the Palestinians and supporting them. And as we are marking in these days, the martyrdom of Hashqasem Soleimani has done what the Palestinians deserve and what do better for the Palestinians, which is supporting the armed resistance and helping those resistance factions. And this what happened in the recent years. We have seen that while the Arab governments and monarchs have moved into normalization, the Palestinian units are getting closer to each other and uniting their efforts against this aggression. And I believe that the more the aggressive the Zionists will be, the more our resistance will unite and will bring this illegitimate entity into its immediate and eventual collapse.
Kevin Barrett, our Ramallah correspondent, has said to us many times that Israel is planning to split up Al-Aqsa Mosque in terms of space and time, and that any attempt to change the mosque status quo will explode the existing tensions. How important is it for the status quo of Al-Aqsa to remain intact, and what repercussions would there be if that's not the case?
Well, that's right. There's been a kind of a tenuous peace. I guess peace isn't maybe quite the right word for it, given the ongoing slow-motion genocide of Palestine. But we haven't seen a kind of third world war along religious lines break out, in part because the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which again is the Islamic world's oldest and greatest architectural monument and the spiritual symbol of the universality of the Islamic message, as the symbol of the Miraj of the Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, who encountered all of the other prophets, including the founding prophets of Christianity and Judaism, as he ascended into the nearness of God. That great symbol and that great monument means everything to the Muslims. And the Zionists have a kind of a millenarian messianic mythology that spun off into outright Satanism with Shabtai Zvi in 1666. And those Satanists who have spun off from Judaism and Zionism are dedicated to bringing their false Messiah, their Dajjal or Antichrist, to rule the world by destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque and building a blood sacrifice temple from which the world will be ruled. This is this bizarre millenarian messianic mythology that the ultra-Zionists, and perhaps including Ben-Gvir and his friends, believe in. So keeping the inviolability of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is absolutely paramount in terms of preventing massive global bloodshed if the Zionists do decide to either try to destroy or to take over a portion of this mosque, which Ben-Gavir has announced his intention to do. It's a huge issue, and this is the kind of issue that at least should be talked about honestly in the United Nations, but it hasn't been. And the world's biggest powers that have every reason not to want some kind of huge explosion there that could destabilize the world and interfere with their own interests even, have been slow to talk about this and to try to find a solution to it, because the Zionists, again, they have so much power. And for the Zionists that control the Western media, that dominate Western finance, even though most of them are not Ben-Gavirs themselves, are not that fanatically attached to destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque and putting up a blood sacrifice temple to usher in the reign of the Antichrist. A few of them probably are, but most of them aren't. But they still have this mentality that Jewish interests can do no wrong. And so they won't let the Western governments do anything about this.
Ms. Al-Aqsa, let's talk about the actions of the new extremist Israeli cabinet at just a weekend. To name one instance, there was a visit by the fascist minister Itamar Ben-Gavir to Nafa prison with the aim of harassing the Palestinian prisoners there. Hamas has, of course, responded to that. It's called this an unprecedented criminal act, adding that the extremist occupation government is planning a dangerous escalation that our people will not let it go unnoticed. Are the Israelis, with this new far-right cabinet at its helm, in search of escalating tensions, in your opinion?
I believe that these reckless actions, unfortunately, the Zionists don't learn lessons from their previous experiences. We have seen what happened last summer, last May, during Saif al-Aqsa operations. Unfortunately, they don't learn lessons that as long as they insist in desecrating our holy places and killing our people and murdering our people, their option to resistance became more substantial and more and it's the only key to put an end for these aggressions. I believe that the Muslim population across the globe, especially here in West Asia, must pressure their governments. They must use the alternative media to expose these violations, and to work hard to support the Palestinians, and also the Palestinians must unite, must exert all the possible efforts in order to put an end for these aggressions. I don't believe that the Zionists. I believe that the Zionists take these measures in order to risk to provocate the Palestinians, but the Palestinians will respond, and this is their right to respond and to resist these aggressions.
Kevin Barrett, the office of the new Israeli Prime Minister has just announced financial and political sanctions against the Palestinian Authority in response to their appeal at the International Court of Justice. The regime will also impose a moratorium on some Palestinian construction as well. What are the Israelis trying to achieve with these actions?
Well, they're trying to punish the Palestinian Authority for, in this case, doing the right thing, going to the International Criminal Court, Court of Justice, and trying to get some justice for some of these crimes that have been committed against them. And, of course, the old saying is no good deed goes unpunished. And so the Zionists are punishing the Palestinian Authority for doing something right. And, of course, the Palestinian Authority has done wrong things as well, and it has made too many accommodations with Zionist power. The Zionists think they own the Palestinian Authority, and to some extent they have. They've had a lot of influence over it in the past, at certain points at least. But now I guess they're trying to rein it in, and they're saying, well, if you give in to popular opinion and press these war crimes charges against us, then we will do what we can to make your life more difficult. So that's the sort of thing the Zionists always do. They're always finding ways to retaliate against anyone that's either done something to them or that they imagine has done something to them. And so this, actually, it could be a good thing if the Palestinian leaders realize that it's time to stop dealing with the Zionists. Alan Hart, the former BBC lead correspondent for the for Israel-Palestine, personal friend of Yasser Arafat, Golda Meir, used to say in the last years of his life that the Palestinian Authority really should dissolve itself, and that would make the Israeli occupier 100% responsible for everything happening in the occupied territories, and that would put the ball in the next court. And maybe it's time for the Palestinians to do that. But in any case, this will force the PA closer to the views of the majority of their people.
And Ms. al-Assad, Hamas has pledged to defend al-Aqsa at any price. Islamic Jihad has said Israel is responsible for the repercussions of its actions. The PA has said before that any aggression against al-Aqsa is equivalent to crossing all red lines. Now, Russia's UN envoy in the recent Security Council session recounted the events that took place back in the year 2000 after Ariel Sharon stormed al-Aqsa, sparking the second Palestinian intifada. Analysts and observers say we could be looking at the prelude for a third intifada. How do you see it?
The entire axis of resistance has actually warned against another intifada, because as we have mentioned that the Zionist occupation is manifesting on a daily basis its aggressive hostilities against the Palestinians, against our holy places, murdering Palestinians, Palestinian minors, women, and without full impunity, because the Zionist occupation knows that no one will hold them accountable. And as we see that as I've mentioned, that the Persian Gulf monarchies are turning deaf ears and blind eyes to these aggressions and getting closer to the Zionist enemy. And we see that Ansarullah has warned against the aggressive policies of Zionist enemy, also Hezbollah in Lebanon. We witness the aggressions on daily basis that are targeting Syria, also the Judaization of Manama in Bahrain. All of these movements that are taking place by the Zionist enemy will lead eventually, yes, to another intifada, and perhaps it's time that we will witness the collapse of this temporary Zionist occupation in our West Asia region.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Allow me to thank my guests, editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barra, joining us from Madison, and Lebanese journalist Sandos al-Assad, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And a special thanks to you all for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. قالوا سواء علينا أوعظت أم لم تكن من الواعظين.
They said, it is all the same to us whether you advise or are not of the advisers.
إن هذا إلا خلق الأولين.
This is not but the custom of the former peoples.
وما نحن بمعذبين.
And we are not to be punished.
فكذبوه فأهلكناهم إن في ذلك لآية وما كان أكثرهم مؤمنين.
And they denied him, so we destroyed them. Indeed, in that is a sign. But most of them were not to be believers.
Dear listeners, as you were previously with us, we are done with the 135th verse, and now the next verse of chapter Shu'ara. قالوا سواء علينا أوعدت أم لم تكن من الواعظين. The 136th verse says, they said, it is the same to us whether you admonish or be not of the admonishers. So, by explaining the previous verses, you know that those verses contain the expressive words of the sympathetic Prophet Hud, على نبينا وآله وعليه السلام, with his rebellious people, the odd people. His statements ended with a kind of warning. إني أخاف عليكم عذاب يوم عظيم. Verily, I fear for you the chastisement of a great day. And this is a prophet. He is totally sincere with the words. When he says, إني أخاف عليكم, he is really afraid for his people, because those are his people. He is أخوهم هود, as the Holy Quran explains. He is one of their brothers somehow. So if you want to somehow sympathize with the people, you need to be from them, so that like this, they might accept your call. They might return to themselves, think about the blessings, and accept the concept of monotheism. It would be better for us to think about all the different methods of invitation of the prophets from the beginning of this very chapter, chapter Shu'ara, and how the Almighty Allah introduces these prophets and how they set their plans to invite their own people. They had different methods, all of which leads to inviting people to monotheism, but with different ways and different methods. Some started with the warning. Some started with mentioning the different blessings of the Almighty Allah and somehow stimulating the sense of thanksgiving in them, etc. So this is really important, how every prophet is talking to their own people. Because with different people, you need to talk like them.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
in this series of programs. We will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Anyway, dear listeners, now the Holy Quran in this 136th verse refers to the irrational, vicious answers of that group of people who told Hud that he would not put himself into trouble because it was indifferent to them whether he admonished them or not, and his admonition would not have any effect on their hearts. قَالُوا سَوَاءٌ عَلَيْنَا أَوَعَذْتَ أَمْ لَمْ تَكُمْ مِنَ الْوَعِذِينَ They said, it is the same to us whether you admonish or be not of the admonishers. This is really significant. If you are not ready, if there is no capacity and readiness in the people to accept the truth, even if the words are coming from the mouth of a prophet, even if the truth is presented by an infallible imam or by a prophet, the people would not accept because they do not want to. So here in this case, they even explicitly say that your admonitions are not going to affect us because our hearts are sealed. سَوَاءٌ عَلَيْنَا أَوَعَذْتَ أَمْ لَمْ تَكُمْ مِنَ الْوَعَذِينَ This is a very heavy statement for a prophet that does his best to invite people. He sympathizes with them. He says, إِنِّي أَخَافُ عَلَيْكُمْ He is sincerely telling them that I am so worried about you. But in answer, in return, what he gets is, سَوَاءٌ عَلَيْنَا أَوَعَذْتَ أَمْ لَمْ تَكُمْ مِنَ الْوَعَذِينَ They say it is the same to us. You want to admonish or not, we are persisting, we are continuing on what we were doing previously. We will, God willing, move on to the next verses and how they continue this irrational answers of theirs in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us in this episode, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website, at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
When faith begins.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A mass rally has been staged in the Yemeni capital along with several other Yemeni provinces called Al-Hisar Harb Alayna, which translates to "The siege is war upon us." Yemen is experiencing one of the worst humanitarian crises in history due to what protesters call the U.S. and Saudi Arabia strangling blockade on innocent civilians. Demonstrators called for an immediate end to the blockade and the ongoing war.
Al-Azimat al-Mubarakah.
We came out in this blessed protest to tell the aggressors and their allies that their blockade is a war on us. Therefore, we, the Yemeni people, say if you do not lift your blockade, we will certainly teach you a lesson you will never forget. We will not sit back and watch our people starve to death.
We came out to deliver a message to the world that we will no longer remain silent on this aggression, war, and blockade on our people.
Yemen's military spokesperson reiterated this week that if the Saudi-led coalition fails to lift the blockade, the Yemeni army will have no choice but to use military force to break the siege. Protesters in Sana'a expressed that it's time to use the military card, since the Saudi-led coalition continues to seize Yemeni fuel ships in the Red Sea.
We came out today to tell our military forces to go ahead and strike the capital cities of our enemies so they can be forced to leave the blockade by the will of Allah. Only then they will live in disgrace and humility.
The protest comes after a week of violence stemming from the continuous Saudi shelling in the northern province of Sada, which has killed and injured dozens of civilians over the past 2 weeks. Furthermore, Saudi Arabia continues to seize and detain Yemeni fuel ships in the Red Sea, preventing them from reaching the port of Hodeidah and unloading the much-needed fuel supply. The Saudi-led coalition attacked Yemen in 2015, declaring they would defeat the Ansar Allah movement and their allies within a matter of weeks. It is now 2023, and they have not achieved any of their goals. This, as the Yemeni government based in Sana'a continues to advance its military deterrence capabilities. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
St. Pancras Station, one of London's biggest and busiest. But not today. A 48-hour strike by train drivers, preceded by another 48-hour walkout by other rail workers, have meant travel misery for thousands. The dispute between ASLEF and the RMT Rail Workers Union on the one hand, and the employer Network Rail and train operating companies on the other, is largely over pay and the impact of inflation on workers' wages. But disagreements have kept a deal elusive for months.
Well, we want to hear movement on the issue about some of the conditions they've put down in Network Rail. That's a restructuring of all our members' terms and conditions. And it's a similar recipe in the train operating companies. They've gone for a thing called driver-only operation, which we think is extremely unhelpful. We can't accept that. And, of course, we'd like an improvement in the pay offers.
Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has so far refused to meet with the unions to try and hammer out a deal and has instead vowed to get tough on the strikes. His government is also accused of trying to turn public opinion against the strikers. But there's no sign of that happening yet.
I think workers are well within their rights to demand at least living wages to be kept in line with inflation. So, yeah, I'm fully supportive of this.
I really sympathise. I think they're right. So I'm not mad. It's inconvenient.
The UK economy is experiencing the combined effects of Brexit, the war in Ukraine, and its effect on energy costs, as well as inflationary pressure on the post-pandemic recovery. And rail workers are not the only ones complaining.
ASLEF and the RMT are two of the UK's most powerful unions, able to bring their railway service to a standstill during industrial disputes. And the concerns they have been raising about the difference between people's pay packets and the cost of living at the moment are shared by many different industries and professions.
Nurses, ambulance drivers, teachers, postal workers, driving examiners and the like all have pay deals with the government in the pipelines and are likely to be offered less than the rate of inflation. And that means the UK's winter of discontent is likely to drag on. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Veteran Iranian politicians were present alongside foreign activists, scholars, and researchers on the second and final day of the first international conference on Martyr Soleimani's School of Thought. Panel discussions shed light on different dimensions of Martyr Soleimani's life and legacy.
You have to live with people like Martyr Soleimani to understand why they chose that certain lifestyle. Not only that, but even more important is how they choose to die. This makes people like Martyr Soleimani stand out.
According to the participants of the conference, Martyr Soleimani had a deep understanding of politics and based his views on the guidelines of the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. They say this is the most important reason why he should always be remembered.
It is our national duty to keep the memory of Martyr Soleimani alive. He is a role model for future generations, and we need to elaborate on his school of thought for the next generation to walk down the same path.
My husband is in prison in our country, the Republic of Azerbaijan, since 2011, when he was sentenced to 12 years in prison for protesting against the ban on hijab. He was inspired by Martyr Soleimani. It is very important to introduce Martyr Soleimani to the world and the younger generation.
The plight of the Palestinians was another topic high on the agenda.
This conference is of great importance because one of the major goals of Martyr Soleimani was to liberate Palestine, and this is also one of the major issues that was pointed out in the panel discussion. It has also been mentioned in the final statement of the conference.
Eight panels separately focused on different dimensions of Martyr Soleimani's school of thought, from his personal life to his teachings and great leadership skills. However, his views regarding international politics received more attention.
I think we can highlight three points. One, deals with the role that General Soleimani had in stopping U.S. hegemonic designs for the Middle East. The second point was his ability to organize people, to create networks of like-minded people. He was a religious man, he was an ethical man, he was someone that attracted people, and that was one of the reasons that he was successful.
While the organizers of the conference have decided to set up a permanent secretariat, they say they are open to receiving more research papers, projects, and books for the next conference, which will be focusing more on the legacy of a man who is known for making great efforts in eradicating insecurity in the region. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani fought for peace, security, and stability in the region. According to the participants of this conference, his greatest legacy and achievement was eliminating Daesh terrorists. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Historic electoral breakdowns in the United States continue to multiply. For the first time in 100 years, Congress has failed to immediately elect a speaker for the House of Representatives, which is the nation's number three post following the vice president. After 2 days and more than a handful of votes, a group of around 20 so-called Trumpist lawmakers continue to reject the mainstream Republican, Kevin McCarthy. An irony is that Donald Trump urged Republicans to unite behind McCarthy, a reflection of the deep divisions in a politically reconfigured nation.
It's kind of the Republican establishment not knowing how to deal with the monster that both the corporate and right-wing media systems have kind of created over the last kind of period, the emergence of Trump as a political figure and then the rise of Trumpism. It's really kind of gotten away from at least the establishment Republicans that would very much like to be able to wash their hands of January 6th and can't.
The failure to choose a speaker reduces Congress' total standstill, with legislation impossible. The only legal solution is for someone to finally win a majority. In 1855, that took 2 months and 133 rounds of voting. The Republican red wave of 2022 only produced such a narrow midterm victory that even a small group of their lawmakers can exert a huge amount of influence. The hardline stance of the dissenting Republicans is actually what many Democrat supporters expected out of the so-called squad of alleged progressives after their party's even narrower blue wave win in 2020.
Very much kind of putting to shame the squad and showing that being a unified bloc, even if you're a minority, if you take a fighting stance and you don't go along to get along, you can fight for meaningful wins. Unfortunately, now we have an example from the right.
The caucus of dissenters is often described as far right, while others note that their nominee for speaker is an African American and that their demands include more transparency in legislation and less power for congressional leaders. Many expected that a divided Congress would produce squabbles and political stagnation, but perhaps not this quickly. The electoral dysfunction at the federal level continues to embarrass and perhaps discredit democracy with American characteristics. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
While the world celebrates the start of a new year with festivities and a display of fireworks, Yemen ushers in the new year with fireworks from artillery shelling by the Saudi-led coalition. In just the first hours of 2023, Saudi Arabia carried out a series of artillery shelling in northern Yemen close to Saudi borders. According to the reports, at least 18 innocents were injured in the latest attacks. This comes after a year of bloodshed, according to the Humanity Eye Center for Rights and Development. In their latest report for the year 2022, the center revealed statistics of war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition. According to the report, over 3,000 Yemenis were killed and injured in 2022.
Humanity Ice Center statistic and research analyst Gais Jamal reports that these crimes occurred near the Saudi border during a ceasefire.
In the year 2022, most of the crimes were committed on residents living in bordering districts with Saudi Arabia, despite the announcement of a ceasefire. The only thing that stopped was the airstrikes. However, Saudi rockets and artillery shelling continued. There was no ceasefire in the districts near the Saudi border. From the first day the ceasefire was announced, the attacks continued until this day.
Saudi Arabia and its coalition also attacked airports, Yemeni ports, and almost 15,000 homes, livestock farms, and communication stations in 2020, according to the report. Humanity Eye says it has all the evidence to prove that Saudi-led coalition committed war crimes on a mass scale.
We have met with French rights groups and presented to them reports with evidence that expose how Saudi Arabia and its allies and European states played a direct role in supporting Saudi Arabia with weapons that were used to commit war crimes on Yemenis. We presented all necessary evidence to this French rights group, and they have filed a case in court against Mohammed bin Salman and bin Zayed for the war crimes committed. This case is currently pending.
The European legal system is unlikely to bring any Saudi or UAE official to justice, which is why Yemenis want justice now.
We are calling on our government to take tough military actions against the aggressors. They are occupying our lands, destroying our homes, and killing us, and we will not remain silent for much longer. We are a free Yemeni nation with a great civilization. We have the right to defend ourselves.
The Yemeni people are suffering from the blockade and the oppression being spearheaded by Saudi Arabia. Therefore, we call on the Yemeni government to take decisive actions now to lift the blockade and end the suffering of the people.
As the conflict enters a new year, tensions are steadily rising on all active battlefronts in Yemen between Saudi-led forces and the Yemeni army. If a peaceful resolution is not reached soon, an all-out war is likely to ensue. Pressure is beginning to mount on the Yemeni government to end the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition as millions of Yemenis continue to suffer. Yemenis we spoke with are calling on the Ansar Allah movement to end the siege now by any means necessary. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
The start of the new year has brought bad news for the Italians. The average price of unleaded petrol at the pump in Italy has once again surged, increasing by over 15 cents. That is about 15% more compared to December 31st. The latest hike is due to the expiration of measures introduced in May to mitigate the nefarious effects on Italy's economy of an exceptionally high increase in the cost of energy that followed the start of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. The price of unleaded petrol stands now at about 1.8 euros per litre, while that of diesel has reached almost 2 euros.
The increase in fuel costs at the turn of the new year is mainly due to the reinstatement of the full rates of excise duty and VAT on petrol, diesel and LPG that the former government led by Mario Draghi introduced last year. The spike is also due to the higher cost of mixing biofuels with petrol and diesel as required by the law.
Experts fear fuel prices might even increase further after February the 5th, when a European Union ban on Russian oil product imports kicks in as part of sanctions against Moscow over the war in Ukraine. This follows a ban on Russian crude that took effect in December.
With a population of 59 million and about 40 million circulating vehicles, it is easy to understand how vital is the role of road transport in Italy. It accounts for three quarters of all land transportation of goods. It goes without saying that the country's rising fuel costs for both petrol and diesel will have dreadful consequences for medium and small businesses and for everyday people.
While wages remain the same, fuel in general, energy costs keep rising. I'm very worried. Too much uncertainty.
What worries me the most is the fact that wages remain unchanged while the cost of living is skyrocketing. I have four kids and we are struggling to make ends meet.
Higher fuel prices further swell living costs for people in Italy as electricity and gas bills have increased by about 300% since September. Italy was expecting to raise almost 10 billion euros from measures targeting the super profits made by energy companies that benefited from the surge in oil and gas prices. So far, only one quarter of that amount has been paid to the tax office. Max Civili, Rome.
Three years have passed since the U.S. assassination of top Iranian military commander General Qasem Soleimani, one of the dozens of commemoration ceremonies that have been held across Iran. Senior military and state officials attend a gathering in Tehran to pay their respect to General Soleimani.
Martyr Soleimani was the forerunner of all the martyrs who lost their lives in the fight against terrorism. That's why his name continues to be remembered by Iranians.
Not only did the American authorities committed this crime, but they openly took responsibility for it. We have been following up on our legal pursuit with the cooperation of Iraq's judiciary to bring the perpetrators to justice.
Soleimani was the commander of a branch of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps called the Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He was killed on January 3, 2020, in a drone strike outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump. Millions took part in his funeral, both in Iraq and Iran. Now, on his third assassination anniversary, Iranians still feel the loss.
It's been 3 years now that we lost our commander. We call him the Commander of Hearts because he fought Daesh overseas to keep the terrorists at bay and prevent them from entering our soil. We owe our security to General Soleimani.
General Soleimani is known for his role in eliminating Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also led major operations in Syria that led to the recapturing of key areas from Daesh. That's why his assassination is viewed as a huge loss for the region and a big win for the terrorists.
People here say General Soleimani's assassination gave a clear clue about who is who in the fight against terrorism in the region. They say the U.S. killed the nemesis of Daesh, and that corroborates Trump's claim that America created Daesh. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Imam Khomeini's viewpoint on condition of leadership. I was and I'm still believing and I'm insisting on the belief that it is not necessary that an Islamic leader should be a murja, a just mujtahid or high-rank religious authority chosen by the honored experts who are the representatives of the whole country in the assembly of experts is just enough. When the people vote for the experts in order that they appoint a just mujtahid to rule them and those experts, then has really assigned someone to the leadership post, the leadership of such a person would be accepted by the people. In such a case, this person becomes the wali or leader that has been elected by the people and whose orders and commands are consequently effective.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. I'm your host Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the mosque. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has mentioned that the mosque is an Islamic fortress